Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Thank you for joining us on today's DenverBroncos.com podcast. In all likelihood, it might be the last one of the season until we get back after the Super Bowl, because I don't think it's going to make it into my luggage. I don't think I have room.
For the mixer? Yeah.
Yeah, for the mixer. So we might be able to do it otherwise, but...
It's kind of tough on this trip. I mean, it's great to be going, but have one bag under the in the storage area of the airplane, and then what you can carry on. So I don't know. I'm not sure.
Packing was tight for me. I don't know what you
mean. It was very tight for me as well, and I've got one suitcase underneath the rolling suit, the smaller suitcase that I put in the overhead, and a backpack, and I felt like I was spilling out of everything. So I may have to find a way to, if I get anything souvenir-wise out in the San Francisco Bay Area, I think I'm going to have to go to the UPS store or something, get a box and ship it home, because I'm not going to have room for it.
That'll work.
Yeah.
By the way, happy anniversary. Today is Sunday, January 31st, the anniversary of Super Bowl 33, Broncos' second Super Bowl win over the Falcons. So
yes, I actually, this morning, I remembered it, and I tweeted out a picture of Rod Smith catching the pass past Eugene Robinson for the touchdown. Eugene Robinson, of course, who will be at Super Bowl 50 because he is now the Carolina Panthers radio color commentator.
Hmm.
And something tells me Rod Smith will be in the building as well. So,
well, we've already seen him on the practice field. He was out here on Saturday for practice, hanging around. Good to have that kind of presence, I think.
I think there'll be a lot. I think there'll be quite a few former Broncos players there. Certainly
going to be three.
There are three that we know of. Three that are going to be Hall of Fame finalists, and thus hopefully will be at least one of them will be honored as a Hall of Famer at Super Bowl 50. John Lynch, Steve Atwater, and Terrell Davis. And just, I mean, really, we don't know what's to come, obviously, but this has the makings of an exceptionally special week for the Denver Broncos on multiple levels. Being in the Super Bowl, Peyton, all the talk about Peyton Manning, what his future is going to be. There's obviously a lot of publicity about the last rodeo comments that he made to Bill Belichick that were captured by NFL films. But certainly, clearly, whether it's Manning's last rodeo or not, you see him marinating in this moment. He had his son Marshall with him at the press conference last week after the AFC Championship win. He was out in the field with his family in the hours after the game. He's certainly trying to enjoy and savor every moment, it seems. And so, what that means, I think only Peyton Manning knows. But certainly, you can tell it's something different, even than his previous three Super Bowl appearances. And then for the Broncos as a whole, getting back here for the second time in 3 years, and now trying to get that third title, that one that everyone knows will be for Pat Bowlen. You know that John Elway wants so desperately to say this one's for Pat.
Yes.
And hopefully the team will make it happen next Sunday.
Yep. Team President and CEO Joe Ellis spoke to the team in its huddle in its last practice at UC Health Training Center on Saturday before they leave to finish off the season with practices at Stanford University, heading up to the Super Bowl, and then
John Elway's alma mater.
Yes, so I wonder how they got that to work out.
That was set long ago. The AFC was going to be at Stanford, and the NFC was going to be at San Jose State. It's part of it is the logistics. The Panthers are staying in downtown San Jose. The Broncos are staying in Santa Clara, just a little ways west of there. So obviously, geographically, if the Panthers had been training at Stanford, they would have had a 17-mile haul. Instead, the Broncos have a 12-mile trek up to Palo Alto, and then the Panthers will be at San Jose State. What I find very interesting is neither team is using one of the two NFL facilities right there in the Bay Area. You have the 49ers facility and the Raiders facility. Now, the Raiders facility, obviously, it probably needs a little bit of work and a little bit of love, but curious that the 49ers facility wasn't used, because back in Super Bowl 48, two teams in the market, the Jets and the Giants. Broncos train at the Jets facility. Seahawks train at the Giants facility. Very, very interesting move, I think.
Well, as for the Hall of Fame announcement, that'll be during the NFL Honor Show on Saturday, February 6th. You can catch that on CBS, I believe, at 9 Eastern, so 7 Mountain Time. I think most of our listeners are going to be Mountain Time. Well, enough of the lead-up. Let's just get to the actual Super Bowl event itself, and it's time for our big reveal. We've heard from you all season about how much you've been complaining about, how much we talk about Carolina and Charlotte. Well, now you see why. It's because we knew all along that they'd be facing the Denver Broncos in the Super Bowl, and we were just getting everyone ready for
exactly. that. Exactly. Laying the groundwork for 17 weeks in the regular season and beyond. You know, the fact that Kelvin Benjamin tore his ACL in training camp at Wofford College, that didn't deter us.
My goodness. People thought that the team was going to just fall apart offensively because he was going to be out.
Oh, yeah. People all of a sudden. And there wasn't a lot of buzz around the Panthers even before Benjamin's
coming
injury.
Off 7-8-1.
7-8-1. A lot of you know the picks, the predictions for the NFC South were wide open. Some thought the Saints would get it back together. A fair amount of people picked the Falcons, who went down to the last game in the 2014 season with the Panthers and then fell, and then Mike Smith and the coaching and a lot of the coaches got fired. So. When Benjamin was lost, all of a sudden the Panthers kind of just fell off the radar completely, and then they kind of worked their way up. I mean, they were allowed to evolve and grow quietly.
Yes.
Because people didn't take them seriously, even when they got to 4-0, 5-0. Like, you know, they'd beaten the Texans at home when the Texans had quarterback issues. They'd gone to Ryan Mallett, and after Brian Hoyer had been benched in week one, they beat the Saints when Drew Brees didn't play, and that was a close game. It wasn't until November, I think, that really people started to understand how good the Panthers team was. It was that Green Bay game, actually, I think, where really the Panthers kind of hit the elite.
The national radar.
Yes.
I think if you look at the team itself and its turning point for the season, and we've talked about this a little bit, is that the game where they went to Seattle, mounted a comeback in the fourth quarter, in the home of the 12s, I mean, that has to be the turning, well, not maybe not the turning point, but the catalyst point of that season for them is that they could beat Seattle, the team who had been stopping them each year.
For years, yeah, it was the hump they had to get over. It wasn't just the playoff loss in Seattle last January. It was 2012, 2013, 2014, in the regular season, Seattle coming to Charlotte each time, pulling out a close win each time. I mean, it was frustrating. Certainly in 2012, it kind of, when the Panthers, you know, were still struggling, and even, of course, even as late as early 2013, Ron Rivera was on the hot seat. It's hard to imagine that now. He's clearly one of the best coaches in the game. But early in 2013, you know, people wanted him fired. 2012, that game against Seattle was about the only indicator the Panthers had of how close they actually were to breaking through. And then, of course, they actually do it in 2013, but don't beat Seattle. And then in 2014, they lose to Seattle again. So getting that win in Seattle was massive. And I think it carried them through in the playoffs when they took that 31-0 lead. And then the Seahawks came roaring back in the second half. I didn't sense any panic from the Panthers, you know, even as the Seahawks were putting together one good drive after another. I think they had that confidence and that belief in themselves, and that carries through against everybody they've played. There's a deep belief that they can get it done. And the other thing is, you know, they start so fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Peyton Manning has said, it's like they're up 14-0 before the national anthem has been sung. You know, the offense and defense complement each other so well. Defense gets takeaways. The offense takes it the rest of the way.
Sometimes they don't need the offense to take the rest of the way, and the defense does it itself.
Yep, 7 touchdowns on various returns, defense and special teams.
Well, Kikwe with 2 in the postseason.
Yeah, it just incredible. And that actually brings us to one thing the Broncos have to focus on in this game. Don't turn the football over. They've done a good job since Peyton Manning came back in against San Diego of avoiding giveaways. Only the one brain lock giveaway when Ronnie Hillman didn't chase down the lateral and New England recovered. And I mean, if you don't have that play, are we even talking about the AFC Championship being a close game?
Possibly not.
Yeah, that I mean,
the offense wasn't really doing anything until the last drive where they just.
Mm-hmm.
Where they were facing two backup safeties.
Right.
Realistically, so, third stringer safeties.
Yeah, two safeties who weren't even on the roster.
Yeah.
When December began. So, yeah, that's a reminder that you've got that everyone has to be on point, avoid the mental mistakes. You can't make those errors against the Panthers because they will pounce. They're the league's best team at capitalizing on your own errors. So, for Peyton Manning, he's been smart throughout the postseason. He's got to continue to do that. Fans may boo a 7-yard check down on 3rd and 15. It's better than forcing it and getting picked off.
And they have playmakers at every level. Defensive line, Kaywon Short, Charles Johnson, linebackers. I mean,
Kuechly and Thomas Davis.
Thomas Davis, who you think is expecting to play, broke his arm in that NFC Championship game.
Probably won't be able to do much with the football and with that arm. Won't be able to do much in short area coverage, I imagine, in terms of putting his arm on a guy. Maybe you try to set up some matchups with Owen Daniels on him to capitalize on that, but I think it would take a near-fatal illness to keep Thomas Davis off the field for this game. I mean, it means so much to him. He's come back from 3 torn ACLs. There's no tougher player that you'll find in the National Football League than Thomas Davis. He'll be ready.
And at the secondary, I mean, you start off with Josh Norman, who is really risen in the ranks of at his position to the conversation of best corner in the league. Roman Harper, who's been doing this a long time.
Kirk Coleman.
Yeah, Kirk
who's
Coleman.
Who's emerged from the ether. And he plays well off of Josh Norman in particular, you know, taking advantage of the fact that, you know, teams aren't going to throw at Norman. So he's able to supplement Robert McClain and Cortland Finnegan. And make some plays when teams do try to exploit those matchups. Coleman's very good at reading the intent of a quarterback, very good at reading his eyes, very good at getting in a position to make a play. But that said, I mentioned McClain and Finnegan. Those are two cornerbacks that you can make some plays on. And if Peyton Manning, with his abilities pre-snap, if he can find ways to get the safeties a little bit out of position and in unfavorable spots for them and get man coverage from Finnegan, and McClain on Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders and Cody Latimer and Benny Fowler and whoever else lines up, I think he's going to take his chances and I think he's going to be able to make some plays.
And the reason those guys have been moved up is because of injuries to their secondary, mm-hmm. Particularly Charles Tillman, Peanut Tillman, and Ben Wickery. So
yeah, and Finnegan and McClain were, you know, Finnegan was brought in, I think, December, I believe.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean,
really late in the year.
Yeah, you know, very similar to the Broncos' safeties in the AFC Championship game by the end of it. You know, it's funny how every year for every team it seems like there's a cluster of injuries at one position or two positions.
Mm-hmm.
In the Broncos' case, it's turned out to be safety, although they are expecting both Darian Stewart and T.J. Ward to play, and offensive tackle. Managed to overcome them, and for the Panthers, a cluster of injuries at cornerback and also wide receiver because, you know, not only did you have Kelvin Benjamin out for the year, but Devin Funchess had his progress sidetracked by a hamstring injury, and he's only in the last few weeks really started to show his potential. Boy, you look at them next year, talk about a very dangerous set of big targets in Funchess and Benjamin and then Greg Olsen on the inside. But right now, Funchess still is becoming who he's going to be.
Now, we talked about the offense and dancing around it without somehow touching on Cam Newton, who is obviously going to be the NFL's MVP. There's no way about it. He is going to receive that award.
They might
Saturday
have
night.
Both MVPs.
Defensive and offense.
Yeah, because Kuechly's got an excellent case for defensive MVP.
Yeah.
It tells you how good that this team is, that they may have the best players on each side of the football this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you go 15-1. You have uber talented players at their apex.
Understatement of the year, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, Cam has obviously the defense helps them get into short fields offensively, mm-hmm. but Cam has been able to do it all with a decimated wide receiver core that still gets solid production, I would say.
Ted Ginn has 10 touchdowns.
Yes. So
I never thought I'd say those words.
And Philly Brown has been able to do some stuff with his speed, but Greg Olsen is the top target for them, his size. And Cam just finds him so easily. You need to look no further than that touchdown against the Seahawks.
Not as physically imposing as Rob Gronkowski, but the same ability to make plays in traffic. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as Gronk made that catch in double coverage on 4th and 10 a week ago, you can see Greg Olsen making that kind of play as well. He's properly defended. You got the safety. You got the deep safety. Chris Harris was kind of the safety who was up in the box handling the slot at that point, and he was on Gronkowski late because of injuries. So you had the deep safety. And you had Chris Harris from underneath, who was beaten by a step but caught up as the ball came in, and Gronk still made the play. And Greg Olsen can make those kinds of plays too.
Great hands, mm-hmm. Cam. What more can we say about Cam? Because I mean, he's as talented a quarterback in the pocket as he is running the ball, and because of his size, because of his bulk, because he's so strong that they can run the ball with him consistently as design quarterback runs like no team else can.
Yeah, sure, they can use him in short yardage, and what makes one of the reasons why the Panthers are so good in third and short, third and two, third and three, even third and four, is because you've got him and you got Jonathan Stewart. Mm-hmm. And both of those guys are easily capable of getting the yardage. It'll be interesting to see how the Broncos try to counter that, because one of the things that makes the zone read work so well for them is that it's not just Cam. It's that Jonathan Stewart is so productive as a threat on the inside. So you can't simply go all out and sell out to stop Cam Newton when they go zone read. You've got to take seriously the threat of Jonathan Stewart. So guys have to stay in their lanes, to use the old John Fox cliche. Stay in your lane. You can't get caught out of position, because if you are and you overcommit, one of those two is going to run right by you for a big play.
Jonathan Stewart reminds me a little bit of a lighter C.J. Anderson, the way he can maneuver inside the trenches.
Makes the first guy miss.
Yes.
You know, it's...
When you want to see how dangerous the Panthers' offense can be, you just look to that first half against the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. From the first play, Jonathan Stewart busts a big run.
Big 59-yarder, right, just like that.
And then they can end it in the red zone. They're a dangerous offense. They might not be the most efficient offense, like maybe the Patriots were, but they get things done.
I think it's not a coincidence that one of the Panthers' three losses was one of the three games that Jonathan Stewart didn't play against Atlanta. And part of that is if you can contain Stewart, or in that case Atlanta didn't have to face him, but if you can contain Stewart, and I think the Broncos actually have the personnel to do this because they have – I would say the best pair of three technique ends in the league, mm-hmm. in Malik Jackson and Derek Wolfe. And then you have Sylvester Williams, who's plugging the middle, and then you have Brandon Marshall and Dane Trevathan, who are filling those gaps. So if you can take away the threat of the inside run, you distill it down to Cam Newton. That's dangerous, yes, putting the game in Cam Newton's hands. But when you've got the cornerbacks the Broncos have, and I would say that even though the Panthers have played the Seahawks, I don't think that the Seahawks this year, their cornerbacks, are in the class of Aqib Talib, Chris Harris Jr., and Bradley Roby as a trio. So you expect that there will be tighter and better coverage on Carolina's wide receivers than there has been at any point in this season. And so you've distilled it down to Cam Newton either trying to throw into a very narrow window or run the ball. And then what he does on the outside, you've got Von Miller on one side, you've got DeMarcus Ware on the other. They're great pass rushers, but one of the things that makes them great is they're also very disciplined. Watch them against other mobile quarterbacks. I'm not saying that containing Teddy Bridgewater is quite the same as containing Cam Newton, but there are principles that you can apply from that in terms of setting the edge properly, in terms of not getting caught out of position. Both of them are very good at that. So Denver's defense poses some challenges for Carolina that, frankly, when I watch the Panthers film, they haven't really seen to this point.
They open as a pretty solid favorite. I think 5.5 is the last line I've seen. And when you talk about the pass rush in the top five teams in sacks per pass attempt, the Panthers have played two, the 4 and 5 teams. That is Green Bay, I think, at number 5, and Houston at number 4. Houston's a completely different team than they were at the beginning of the season. However, those two teams were ones the Panthers escaped with wins by a touchdown, 8 points in the case of Green Bay, who mounted a pretty furious comeback. So
Houston had a chance to, I believe, tie the game at the end. Yeah, they went 8 again. Even with Ryan Mallett at quarterback.
Yeah.
You know, if you gave them a good quarterback, a better offense, maybe we're talking about the Panthers not threatening to go unbeaten. Maybe they're 1-1 after two games.
Well, and then, so frankly, when I hear that the Carolina Panthers are so heavily favored in this game, I feel like that they just haven't played a defense like this Broncos defense. Not this, that's not a knock against the Panthers, because you don't just go 15-1 because, like, you don't have weak schedules. Some teams have weaker schedules, but they just haven't played a top defense like this one.
Vegas, when they set the odds, obviously, but it's based on the action they've got coming in. But it's also based on the initial odds are lean heavily on numbers, and in particular net points. That's something that Vegas pays a lot of attention to in terms of setting its lines. The Panthers are number one in the league in net points. They're plus 192 this year. That's a big part of why they're favored. They blew out a lot of teams. The Broncos, as we know, have gotten by the skin of their teeth.
Yes.
11 wins by 7 points or fewer. Part of that, I think, is they've had a tougher schedule. Part of that is just the style of football they play. Defensive-oriented teams tend to play a lot of games like that historically that come down to one or two plays at the end. Especially when the offense has struggled. I think the most fascinating comment of the week was from Rick Dennison talking about the offense and admitting that it's not where he wants it to be. That sometimes it's still frustrating. I think he's saying what a lot of fans feel, quite frankly, what a lot of players feel, that here we are we're going into the Super Bowl and the offense still hasn't really clicked.
Yeah.
So you have to assume it's not all of a sudden going to wave a magic wand and click.
In the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it's nice to think about. And, hey, exceptions to the rule have happened in Super Bowls before. I mean, the game is a completely different animal than anything up to this point. There's a big difference between the regular season and the playoffs, and there's a big difference between the playoffs and the Super Bowl. In part, it's because both teams are exceptional if they get to that point. And the emotion that you have means that things tend to snowball in Super Bowls. That's why sometimes you get blowouts between two teams, even if they're very close on paper. You know, the Seahawks weren't 35 points better every time out than the Broncos, but things snowballed on the Broncos 2 years ago. That's how it happened. So I think my general point is Denver's style has forced it to play a lot of close games. Denver is a little more battle tested in close games than Carolina is. I think that helps them. It's not to denigrate what the Panthers have done. The Panthers have had an exceptional season, but I think if there is a tight game, if there is adversity, I think the Broncos are better equipped to handle it.
One thing I think that's interesting about the concept of an underdog and a favorite is that each of these teams love being the underdog. You look at the Panthers, and their secondary has kind of talked a lot about how much they feel like they've been overlooked throughout their careers. I mean, you look at the draft status of much of that defense, and the only exceptions are Roman Harper and Charles Tillman, who are added to the roster because people think they're
Keuchel was a first rounder, but a lot of people thought he'd go higher.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing with Keuchel is the Panthers did not have a need at that position in 2012. Give then general manager Marty Herney credit for saying, okay, he's the best guy on the board. See, teams fall into trouble when they don't pick the best guy, when they end up picking for need or picking for scheme fit. Another great comment this week from Wade Phillips, talking about how, you know, if a player can't, you say, oh, he can't fit in your scheme, then something's wrong with your scheme. Luke Kuechly's on the board. when the Panthers are picking in 2012, it's a no-brainer. You find a way to shoehorn him in because rosters change, schemes change, and he's still going to be contributing for you. It's something I think that we'll revisit over the next few months as the draft nears, because we'll talk about some guys who maybe aren't scheme fits, but they're good players.
Right.
And one thing the Broncos have done is they, in recent years, is whether it's in the draft or in undrafted free agency, they've picked those guys who were the best players and weren't necessarily scheme fits. Von Miller wasn't a scheme fit. When he was drafted, he was, most people thought of him as a 3-4 outside linebacker.
Right.
You know, Broncos said, well, okay, fine, but he can be a strong side backer in the base, and he can be a rush end in the 4-3. That got him going, and now here he is. You know, you've got a 3-4. He is in his natural position. So one reason both these teams are here is they pick the best guys. Even if in the case of Luke Kuechly, he was kind of falling a little bit. You know, sometimes I think teams overthink the draft. You just have to pick the best guys.
Yeah.
And the Broncos have picked, you know, Derek Wolfe's another example of a guy who people didn't think he was a scheme fit.
Now look at him.
Yeah.
It fits perfectly.
Right.
They just gave him an extension.
Yeah. And a lot of these guys can say, people can legitimately lean on the notion that people didn't think they were good enough on both sides. Both these teams have massive chips on their shoulders. I think the Broncos' chip is more profound right now.
I'm just waiting to see what chip the Panthers try and find, because as the overdogs, as a 15-1 team, 17-1 if you include playoffs, they're not going to be a team people are going to pick against a lot. I feel like most people are going to pick them and say they're the best team. I don't know where they're going to find their underdog status, but coming into the game as a favorite, they're going to have to search pretty far. Maybe go into like Bleacher Report or something.
Yeah, who's saying the Panthers aren't a great team at this point? I mean, they may have said that back in September and October. No one's saying that right now. I mean, once you get to 15-1, it doesn't matter who you've played. You've obviously done something right. When you win the NFC Championship game by 34 points over a 13-3 team, you're pretty dadgum good. I think they're getting all the respect that they can handle. I think if they have to play the no respect card, I think they have to search pretty hard. I think the Broncos don't have to search as hard, quite frankly. I mean, I even saw it in the 24 hours after the game against New England. Whether it was some blowhard columnist in Boston, you know, or people or on First Take or whoever. Which, by the way, don't watch First Take. You have better ways to spend your life.
Respect yourself more.
Yes, exactly. You know, I know ESPN's a partner and all, but ESPN can do better than that, better than Skip Bayless and Screamin' A. Smith.
Well, we are actually sitting here at the team office waiting to travel to the airport to head to Santa Clara. Mm-hmm. And before we wrap up the podcast, I want to kind of give our readers a breakdown of how this week is kind of going to shape up, because Sunday there won't be a whole lot. We'll get some stuff of the team leaving and what that looks like, what that scene will be like, and heading to the hotel.
Yeah.
And then Monday is media night, but after that, I'm not really sure what things are going to show up like.
Well, let's see. As far as like how much they talk to the media or just what the week is like, okay. Tuesday, there's Peyton Manning, Gary Kubiak, and I believe about 10 other players are going to talk to the media.
Okay.
At the team hotel. Wednesday and Thursday, every player will be available to talk. Now, even for a game as wildly covered as the Super Bowl, you still have players that are just kind of sitting there. I mean,
yeah. Well, it's like, yeah. I imagine it might be like the combine when someone like Jameis Winston is going on the
yes,
podium.
Exactly.
There's a guy who's coming out of, I don't know, Coastal Carolina or whatever.
Hey, Josh Norman, I think, probably went through that room and no one bad an eye.
And
they sit there at the table and they just kind of look around and then they wait for, you know, one of the draft-centric publications to come over and then...
Well, that's what I kind of did. I kind of went over there and was like, "Hey, how's it going? How's the week been?"
That's the thing. Like, if I've covered a few Super Bowls, and I find I get the best stuff not from the podiums where everybody is, but talking to the guys kind of off to the side, getting their perspective, and talking to coaches as well, because all the coaches are available. Yeah, all the position coaches, you get kind of get into their stories as well. So, and we'll try to hopefully tell some different stories.
We'll also have
on DenverBroncos.com this week.
We'll also have a live show every day with Mr. Mason over here, along with Broncos TV's Phil Milani and Matt Boyer. That'll be every day at 3:30
Mountain Standard Time. We're going to be live from the hotel, and if we, if I'm not mistaken, if the weather is nice, it'll actually be kind of by the pool.
Ooh, poolside.
Maybe at the end of the week, I'll jump in.
I didn't bring any trunks, so I will not be jumping in.
Yeah. But I think it's a heated pool, and I hope so, because it's not going to be exceptionally warm out there. It'll be, I mean, compared to Denver, it'll be nice, but I think the warmest day is actually going to be game day, about 68 degrees.
Look how that's shaped up. I thought it was going to be raining.
It may still rain. The weather can be kind of capricious. And the last Super Bowl in the Bay Area, Super Bowl 19, it was about 50 degrees, gray skies, fog settled in. If you see the film of that, in fact, when I was packing early this morning, I had the Super Bowl 19 highlight film. The NFL Network was running a marathon of Super Bowl highlight films, and the fog in the second half just takes over. Like, if you were sitting in the top rows of Stanford Stadium, you really couldn't see much of what was going on.
Well, we got some other stuff, some other fun stuff planned. We're going to see how much of it we'll actually be able to do once we get there.
Yes.
But I am planning an interview with Auburn's head coach, Gus Malzahn, who was the offensive coordinator for that national championship year, which Cam Newton obviously led that team to a title.
He needs to wear his Ditka sweater vest for the interview.
It's going to be on Skype, I think, so I'm hoping that it will be. My dad, who went to Auburn, has told me to ask about getting the program righted, because this season was a bit of a disappointment after they were ranked in the top five, I believe. So I don't think I'll be asking that question. It's not really pertinent to the Super Bowl, but I'll be asking him about how to stop Cam Newton, about all things Cam Newton, basically.
Yes.
How he's seen maybe some of the elements that they did at Auburn kind of translate over into that read option they do now. So that'll be interesting. We'll try and do something with Benny Fowler and his friend Draymond Green, obviously an NBA champion.
They'll be out at practice, I imagine.
Yeah.
Fowler will be, but I mean, hopefully Green will get a chance to come out there as well and watch.
We're going to try and do a sit down with them. So we got a lot of fun stuff planned. But one last question I wanted to ask is Super Bowl 50. This is obviously not just a normal Super Bowl. It's one that kind of encapsulates the history of the Super Bowl. Mace, you're a historian. What does this moment kind of mean to you to be a part of it?
It's remarkable. I was reflecting yesterday on how, I mean, I wasn't at the first one, obviously. I wasn't born then. But I was at Super Bowl 25, the silver anniversary of the Super Bowl in Tampa on January 27, 1991, otherwise known as the wide right game for Scott Norwood. And it's pretty cool to be there at 25 and then to have gone to a few since then. And to be at 50, I jokingly said, okay, well, hopefully I'm still around for 75 because I'm going to have to go to that one. And, you know, maybe with a little luck, I'll be around for 100. We'll see. That would be something.
That would be something. That'd be
I'd
really
be,
cool.
Gosh, for a hundred, yeah, I'd 89 years old by Super Bowl 100.
Well, we'll try and get you out to that.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, hey, there's medical advances every day.
Yes.
So hopefully that'll happen. That would be fun. But no, just if you have a chance to see the game program for sale.
Mm-hmm.
The art on it is terrific. It has 50, but it's spelled out in a painting that shows trinkets and stuff from all the Super Bowls to that point. And then you turn inside, there's a little guide to it, like it says which each one. There's a football in there that has from Super Bowl 25, and it's really cool, and it reminds me of the art that they had commissioned for Super Bowl 25 as well, where it was just this kind of this painting of all this memorabilia from the first 25 Super Bowls. I have, in fact, that poster It's in a frame, and when my basement gets redone, I'm going to put it back on the wall, and I'm probably looking for the same poster for Super Bowl 50. Just, it's a tremendous celebration of the history of the sport, but also this game specifically. The notion of the Super Bowl really took pro football to another level. It was already becoming the most popular sport in this country even before the Super Bowl. But getting the NFL and the AFL together, it was really the first tangible example of how the leagues were going to come together and merge. And after, you know, the slow start in the first game really took flight, and now it's become an American cultural touchstone. I mean, to me, the holiday season starts at Thanksgiving and ends at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I'd agree.
And that's the thing. It's a celebration of the sport. It's just a chance to have fun. And the thing about this game, everyone who plays in it, your life has changed forever. I mean, I was thinking in the locker room a couple of days ago, if the Broncos win this game, there's some guy that I'm looking at right now who's going to go down in history. He's going to be talked about for decades. It's going to, you know, going to be, if the Broncos win, somebody, and it may not be a star, it may be, you know, a lesser known player. You know, Shiloh Kao fields the onside kick against the AFC Championship game. Can be any one of the 46 who are active. Someone is going to be a hero that no one sees coming. Mm-hmm. And that someone, if the Broncos win, is never going to have to pay for a meal in Denver the rest of his life. It's totally cool to be a part of it. And hey, if you win this Super Bowl, you get two trophies.
Oh yeah,
you get the Lombardi Trophy, and then you get the gold 50.
If one trophy wasn't enough motivation, now you got two.
It reminds you. It reminds you that every championship, every potential championship, means something. But this is something exceptionally special. I think it'll dawn on the players when they get there. I know, like, the coaches and executives that have been around for a while, it's clear to them that this is something a little bit different.
I think Peyton is the one who might appreciate it maybe more than a lot of people.
Peyton Manning and everyone close to Pat Bowlen, because Bowlen's contributions to the league are legion. It's part of his case for the Hall of Fame, which I think will get him in the Hall of Fame at some point, hopefully very soon. Obviously not this year, but hopefully in the next year or two. He helped the game get to the level it's at right now in terms of prominence. And so it's very appropriate. It would be very appropriate if the Broncos, a team owned by Pat Bowlen, obviously, won this game. And it's also appropriate that the Panthers are in the game because Jerry Richardson is a big league guy as well.
A former player.
Yeah.
So, yeah, on both sides, a lot of fun things going into this game, not just on the field. Mm-hmm. I think with that, we'll wrap it up. Got a few more things to wrap up here at the office before we get on the plane, some last-minute preparations. But we will come to you hopefully with perhaps another podcast before the game. We'll see. I'm not sure if the mixer is going to make it, but we could just do one like we used to do in the old days before we had it. So we'll see. If not, we will come to you with recap of the Super Bowl back here at the office, and hopefully it'll be a happy one. Thanks for listening. Don't forget you can subscribe on iTunes, and don't forget about the live show every day this week of the Super Bowl, 3:30 Mountain Time, DenverBroncos.com. Thanks again. We'll catch you sooner or later.